recorded from the Oklahoma State University Stillwater campus. This is the Inside OSU podcast. Here are your hosts, Megan Robinson and First Cowboy Darren Shrum.
Hello and welcome to the Inside OSU podcast. I am Megan Robinson, joined by my co-host, First Cowboy Darren Shrum. And today with us is Dr. Jill Joyce, an associate professor of nutrition here at Oklahoma State.
Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're so excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Jill, we were talking a little bit before the interview, and Darren was asking, where are you based? But you said that your lab is really in your car. Why are you all over the place on campus and in the Stillwater community?
Yeah, we prospective students will come on campus, and they'll be like, oh, can we show them your lab? And I'm like, well, it's the trunk of my car, so that's a little weird. I don't know if we should take them there. But yeah, Jay and I joke that our lab is the trunk of our car, wherever we park it, because we do a lot of interventions out in fire departments, police departments across the state. So, yeah, I mean, to bring them here, I can't ask them to come here on their day off or in the middle of a shift, especially if they're far away. So we have to be mobile.
So pretty much that's for folks that are already employed, right, either in the police force or maybe a firefighter or EMT, I guess. And so I guess you do really have to work towards their schedule. Yes. So when you go out, do you usually set up a group, or they request you to come? Do you reach out to them first? How does that work?
A little bit of both, although I'd say in the past couple years, since Jay's been established for a long time, so Jay's always in hot demand. But I'm a little bit newer to the scene, like the last 6 years. This is the first place I've worked out of my PhD. And I say since they've kind of caught on that there's a nutrition element too now, I mean, I don't approach people very often. It's more like they're coming to us. Okay. So they'll reach out. We'll go to them. I've actually shifted a lot of things to online because there's so few people doing what I do in the country that I'm trying to reach as many people as possible. And to do that, I kind of need like online as a force multiplier.
Sure.
So I do. Like on Fridays, I offer free nutrition classes on Zoom to anyone in the country that's current or former first responder, military, and their families. That way, if a group's like, can we have nutrition classes? I can be like, I've already got that going on Fridays. Right. Hop on in.
Right.
So I've even moved a little bit mobile in terms of online.
Okay. Is a lot of your requests, are they primarily in-state, or do you get a lot of out-of-state?
Both.
Okay.
Both. Okay. Wisconsin, Colorado, Indiana, California, just all over the place.
Okay.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit. You're mentioning your lab, and I'm like, wait, people listening might not realize what your lab is. What is the lab that you run with Dr. Jay Dawes?
It's the Tactical Fitness and Nutrition Lab.
And what is a tactical athlete who you help within this lab?
So traditional athletes, we all know, you think of sports. Tactical athletes, we can think of in a similar way. They're firefighters, law enforcement officers, military personnel. And we call them tactical athletes because they do a lot of things that athletes do. They might have to run distances or sprint like track. They might have to tackle or throw like football. They might have to climb, all those different things, carry heavy loads. But obviously, it's not a game and for fun necessarily. It's for a more tactical.
It can be life or death, right?
Yeah, it's
for sure.
It is. It's always life or death purpose. Right. Well, I guess maybe not always, but it's safety. Always safety related. Right. So we call them that. I say one thing that I've found I have to be careful with in calling them tactical athletes is that we find that. Sometimes first responders think they're healthier than they truly are because they are a tactical athlete. So I always have to kind of caution them, like, you are a tactical athlete, but you're still at risk for a lot of chronic diseases. So we can't get complacent. We gotta still work on reducing those risks. So I use it wisely.
What are some of the ways in which a diet can impact a tactical athlete?
A lot of ways. On the more like traditional athletic side of things, we do talk about performance nutrition. I need them to be properly fueled. The kind of curve, I'd say it's performance nutrition with curveballs. I think that's probably the most fun part of working with this group, the nerdy fun part, is that And I love pulling them in as examples in class because it trains my students to not get stuck in a rut or assume the usual. Because whatever a dietitian would do with the general population, I promise it won't work in the same manner with my people, with my guys. There's a million curveballs as to why they can't do that. So we take performance nutrition, but then there's the curveballs of, for a track athlete, I could tell them, you need to eat this at this time before the meet, this amount, all that sort of stuff. But I don't know when the event's coming.
Right.
So I have to tweak that and teach them how to fuel properly throughout the day so that they're about ready anytime. But I also have to be concerned that there's a lot of prevalence of overweight and obesity. Mm-hmm. So I can't fuel them too much all the time. So there's a performance nutrition element to fuel the job, but then I have to consider overweight and obesity. There's a high prevalence matching the general population among fire and law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Even the military is a little higher than you would think it is. So they're at risk for that. And then during and after service, heart attack, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, cancer, poor mental health. So I have to use diet for performance, but also improving their health on and then in retirement.
So you do all the way down to dietary suggestions every day and those type of things, along with physical activity, I guess, too. Because, you know, we're talking about, you know, and we'll talk about HPNR in a little bit, but, you know, it's kind of one of those things is that when you talk about a tactical athlete, you know, and help people train, it's like, and I'm going to refer back to HPNRI, it's like everybody thinks that maybe just be an athletic facility, but it's really, it's how you define athlete, right? So mm-hmm. we just think of a traditional athlete, right? Mm-hmm. Sports, you know, those type things. But really, it's, I know Lance likes to use his grandfather, the farmer, right? Mm-hmm. He wants to be able to build fence and hold his grandkids. So his athletic needs are different, but he still needs to do something to be active. And so, you know, that's the thing, because you talk about, you know, police officers, just part of their job is probably spending a lot of time sitting down in that car. You know, and then firemen, my brother's been a fireman for 25 plus years over in Arkansas. And so, you know, I don't know exactly what they do on their 24, 36, whatever they're doing, mm-hmm. you know, at the station. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would think it'd be extremely hard just to balance that out. And it'd be easy to get overweight because you're just sedentary and those type of things. So
absolutely. Depending on where you're working. Yeah. Fire or law enforcement could spend a lot of time sedentary, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So that's where Jay's got, you know, that's his side of things, making sure that they are being active and what does training look like safely. And then I come in on the nutrition piece and accordingly for how much are we active, how much are we not.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, we have to balance all that.
Right, sure.
You mentioned your uncle being a firefighter for 25.
My brother.
Your brother, a 25 firefighter for 25 years. Well, I was thinking, in my hometown, the firefighters were volunteers.
Yes.
How do you deal with those who are volunteers and not trained firefighters?
Well, we were just talking, we're from the same areas-ish originally. And yes, like my area in Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh has, I think, maybe 4 actual career stations in the whole city.
Wow.
I mean, OKC and Tulsa have over 50 stations that are career. And you're right. So for me, volunteer, my uncle and cousin are volunteer firefighters. I live in the suburbs that are as big as Edmond. We have no career firefighters.
Oh.
They're all volunteer. So it's depending on where you are in the country, that could actually be the majority of firefighters. So with them, I'd say working, you know, because they are volunteer. I think a lot of it has to do with the health culture of the department or the readiness of the individual to seek me out. I do have quite a few volunteer departments that'll show up to my classes on Friday or share my diet assessment services and things like that. But I can tell those groups are very ready for change and mm-hmm. very engaged. It is harder to reach the ones who aren't until they're kind of ready for it.
I was kind of curious, you know, so I've gotten to do some cool things on campus, and we have a full-on fire department here. And I didn't mm-hmm. really – my brother's like, yeah, OSU wrote the book on firefighting. I'm like,
oh yes.
He goes, no, literally they wrote the book.
The West
and that's
Point
what, yeah,
of the fire service.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so do you guys coordinate with them when they have their groups? Because I know they bring mm-hmm. different groups in. And so – are you guys coordinated through that effort and talk about nutrition at that point with those folks?
We do try to as much as we can, yes,
right,
definitely.
Right.
Sometimes their schedule's so jam-packed with whatever they're doing with. Usually it's with fire service training through SEAT is where, like, everyone from across the country and even the world, I think it's like 14 countries regularly send people here.
Right,
it's crazy. We if there's time, we'll definitely jump into the what they're offering. We've worked with fire service training through a FEMA grant to create our own nutrition courses with them, and we've worked with them there. We're on fire council, so we try and keep track of what's going on, where can we help and jump in. So yeah, we do work with them a good bit.
Darren, you mentioned in an earlier question the Human Performance and Nutrition Research Institute, HPNRI. How do you plan on collaborating with that institute as it continues to evolve?
Well, it's nice because, like I said, our model does mesh really well with the model of HPNRI, as you mentioned. Like Lance always says that his family comes from farming, and that, I mean, that's an occupational athlete. Holy cow, the physicality of that job. And similar for us in that, and HPNRI and that model of looking at what do we do with athletes and how can we translate that to other non-traditional athletic populations. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've been doing. So the model meshes really, really well. So I think a good way to describe how we can collaborate is through an example of how we're starting to. So I'm really interested in the transition to life after service. Sure.
Which is the majority of life, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah, right.
When we look at the research, military has the most research. Fire and law enforcement transitioning out, we have less research. We see the physical and mental health implications within the first year to two after the transition is almost identical to that of elite athletes transitioning out of sport. Well, we have elite athletes on campus who are often transitioning out of sport. Mm-hmm. So we're working with Lance to, this past year and a half, I have a grad student who is an athlete and just transitioned out. So it's hitting home really hard right now. But we're doing a needs assessment to figure out on the nutrition side, working with Sam Kostelnik, one of the new sports dietitians, what would a transition program look like? What do you want? What do you feel like you need? What would help you? And then this summer, we're working with Lance and Sam to create a pilot nutrition transition program. Now, athletics already has occupational and identity, we're adding to that transition out. But I'm interested in the whole thing because if that model works here, then just like with other things that Jay and I have done in the past, we look at what, traditional athlete, mm-hmm. what works, and then we can flip that for tactical athletes. So we're working on it with traditional, and then we'll flip it for tactical.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So, life after athletics, because you can see it right here on this campus, but I'll just use my example, playing college football and all that back in the 80s. If I go to a reunion, all the guys that were the 150 to 180 pound, 200 pound running backs, quarterbacks, they're all 300 pounds. And, and I think that's what happens, even like current athletes, right? So as soon as their sports is over, they keep eating, but they're not getting the exercise and the physicality portion of that. And it's a hard habit to break. I mean, because my weight has fluctuated 50 pounds up and down since 1986, right? And so it's kind of one of those things that, and it's all about habits, and I think, and what you create. But, I mean, I think that's the most important. Like I said earlier, I think that the nutrition post, your 4 or 5 years as a college athlete, I mean, that's hopefully you've got another 60 years left plus, mm-hmm. And so I think that's the part that I think that all that you guys are trying to accomplish because, as a nation, we're not a healthy people, I mean, if you just look around, that used to be the extreme, with somebody being overweight. Now that's more the commonality, and to see fit people is kind of becoming not the extreme, but very, very small very small part of the group. So, but that's awesome. That's great that you're doing that. And I think HPNRI will definitely help you expand what you do too. So it'll be awesome. So.
Well, and I think in another, translating that, taking that athlete research, translating it to another population, the transition to life after college for every student.
Right.
Nutrition wise, they had the national school lunch program. If they're in Greek life, they now have probably food service in their house, mm-hmm. On campus in the dorms or the dining facilities. But then college ends and you're completely on your own.
Right.
So it, in terms of nutrition, it's a very similar, scholarships financially. I mean, gosh, it's the mirroring is mm-hmm. again, kind of eerie and we could flip that again for college student.
Sure, sure.
Right. So lots of cool opportunities to to use that model.
I was saying, I remember in college, it's like I would just go down to the little convenience store in my building and be like, oh, I'm going to grab this naked juice or grab this. And you're paying for it, but I'm not paying for it because it's on my ID. Yeah. It's with my like campus cash. And then I graduate. And I'm like, wait, I have to pay for coffee? I have to like food is not just like in the dining hall.
Absolutely.
It's definitely a transition.
Yeah.
And now you're on your own for choices as well, right? And I always want the stuff that is the worst for you, right? The sweetest and the thing that wants to make your heart stop.
There's a drive there
for
that.
That's what I want. Exactly. Exactly. Sugar.
Well, Jill, we've talked about your lab and your work in the past. And the one piece of advice that has stuck with me, or the one tip that you give fire departments or police stations, is out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. Keep a basket of fruit on the counter. Don't keep a basket of chips, because you're less likely to seek it out in a cabinet. And that's one thing from like our conversation a couple years ago that has stuck with me. So I have my bowl of apples on the counter.
Yay. Are you eating more apples?
Yeah. I eat apples a lot anyway, and I just don't go out and like buy chips. If chips are put in front of me, I will eat them.
Ditto.
All the time. But I don't go and buy them because I'm like, I don't need that. And then I like go in my cabinet for a snack. I'm like, I want chips.
Well, my husband said that last night.
Yeah, exactly.
You got it.
Other aspect of your work here is you are also a professor, and you recently earned the Undergraduate Research Mentor Award from the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities. What did that mean to you?
Well, first off, I'll say that all credit goes to my students. I have incredibly amazing students who honestly make my job very easy and make me look better than I really am. So kudos goes to them. But I think it means a lot, I'd say, across teaching and research. Like, a common theme is like mentoring people to become the best versions of themselves in whatever area that means. So it was very rewarding to see that hopefully I am being a good mentor and that it is helping people. That's like the ultimate goal, you know, change the world, make people's lives better. So it was very rewarding to get that and see that hopefully the method to my madness is working.
Sure. You can probably be frustrated, you know, from time to time, because we all kind of know what to do, but we just don't do it. And so that's got to be difficult sometimes for you. Like, I'm telling you how to do this, and you're not really cooperating here. So unless you want to see change, you know, you've got to do something different. Yeah. So that's
where I nerdy geek out and get excited, actually. I'm more on kind of the behavior change side.
Sure.
Because I joke with my students that knowing what to eat is actually not the hardest part.
Right.
I would argue that you both know exactly what you should be eating. I'm not going to ask if you're doing that or not.
Right.
And anyone out on the sidewalk, any student, they know what to eat.
Right.
It's doing it that's the hard part.
That's right.
And I think that's the nerdy, the nerdy game to figure out.
Right.
Is okay. Well, what do I got to do to trick you into eating healthy?
To change the habits, right? So I mean, I came out of sales, right? And we used to say it used to take at least 3 to 6 times to make a statement to the same person before you could even think about getting them to change their habits, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing in everything. It's just like, you know, I'll go through, like, right now probably doesn't look like it, but I'm trying to, you know, stop sugar because, you know, and another, you know, things like that you talk about nutrition is, you know, sugar is inflammation. As you get older, you know, your joints ache and hurt. And if I'll eat ice cream, I can feel it 2 days later. I mean, like in my joints, right? And if I just stay away from it, I'm good. But it sure is good, right? You know, put a little chocolate and this and that on it, and it's all incredible. But I don't eat the ice cream. You only live once, right?
Exactly.
Maybe short, but live, right?
So going against Jill's advice, eat the ice cream.
Maybe like once a week.
Moderation, right? Moderation. There you go.
Once a day.
Casey and I, we used to go when we were younger. We first got married. We literally would go to Brahms in Broken Arrow, and we would go have bird cheeseburgers and all that, and we would each eat a banana sundae.
They're
not a sundae, but the banana split. I'm sorry.
So
the whole thing, right?
I'm from the hometown of the banana split. It was created in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. That's where I went to high school. So
it's kind of healthy. You know, it has bananas in it, right?
Yes. I can justify it.
There's fruit. Yeah.
There's strawberries. There's bananas.
It's basically a fruit salad with a little something extra.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Everyone thinks we're the food police. I can also be the master justifier. Depends on who you need.
Who you need to talk to that day. That's right. That's
it's all about moderation. What is it?
Portion control.
Yes.
There you go.
Seriously. If you can do that.
I can't do
that. Then we got to figure out how to make that happen.
If it's there, you got to eat it till it's gone. I was always taught to clean my plate, which is also a bad habit to adopt, because especially with kids, right? Because I've always cleaned my plate since I was a kid. And I probably wouldn't have had the nickname Porky if I hadn't have been, you know, cleaning my plate all the time, right? So.
And I'm a sweets bloodhound. Yeah, if it's in the room, I will find it and I will destroy it.
So I get that.
Well, it's reassuring to hear from a registered dietitian that sweets are okay in moderation. In moderation, everybody. Yeah.
Is that
the
really
key.
What she said?
That's what I heard. That's what I heard. Selective hearing. Jill, I want to go back to your research with your students really quickly, because I did read the article that came out on Oklahoma State about you receiving this honor. What is the most common issue you have or that students have when they're in the middle of a research project that you're able to help guide them with?
I like to use research for a lot to kind of break some bad habits that I know are in pre-health type students, is that oftentimes they're very perfectionistic. So I kind of set them up for opportunities to just completely try things on their own. And obviously I only do it in scenarios where like we can fix the mistake. But I'll give them data and say, here, you know, I'll give you an example of how to code this. You play with coding the rest of the data. And they're like, oh my gosh, like, how do I do this? Give me more rules. And I'm like, nah, figure it out. You can do this. And then they'll come back and we can talk through it. But it's nice to show them that you don't have to be perfect. You can try, you can mess up, and we can fix it. Like, I like to use it as a chance to show them that mistakes are okay. They're learning opportunities. So I'd say that's one thing that I kind of, you know, like to use my research opportunities for. And I'd say the other one is to show them that they can do really hard things, and that challenge is a good thing. Like, there is a such thing as good stress, good challenge to stretch you to grow to the best and most that you can be. 'Cause research is hard.
Right.
So it's a chance to apply and stretch, and that's a good thing.
Sure.
What is it? Like, nothing good ever came from comfort zones? Is that the
quote
or something
very
like
much.
That?
Yeah.
I disagree with that.
It's like, I like my comfort, like zone. Comfort zone.
That's where naps come from.
That's right. As I've gotten older, that 2:30 time hits me like, okay, so are you taking that? No, I'm not. So.
But you I naps.
Yeah. I do. In Europe, right? Don't they do it in Europe? I think, isn't that a common thing?
Yeah, so, siesta. Yeah.
Firefighters, there's some research there. Yeah. Absolutely.
I just need 30 minutes sometime. That's it. You know, and then I'm good to go. So.
Bringing it back to your tactical fitness and nutrition lab, what role do your students play within that lab and that research?
A lot. They, on the research side of things, they're kind of the doers of most of what we do. We're always overseeing and planning it, or they're PhD students, they're planning it to an extent, but they're a lot of the boots on the ground for us on the research side of things. Undergrad, master's, or PhD, to the extent they should be. On the teaching side, education side of things, we have like service learning classes. So like right now, I teach a grad level dietary supplements class, and it's service learning. The groups have been assigned we have fire and military, different firefighting and military units that they are doing needs assessments with, and then creating dietary supplement education materials for that are very tailored to address their needs. So they help me with education, and then outreach. They help me create infographics, fact sheets. Departments and classes will often ask for things, and I can have a dietetic intern do that for supervised practice hours. So they're kind of involved in all three areas of the land grant mission that we address.
So you kind of refer to dietary supplements, so I'm assuming that's vitamins, right? Is that kind
that
of
counts.
What the, it, can,
absolutely.
It does count.
Yep.
Do you believe in those?
I
take 18 a day.
Yeah.
Right, from zinc to glucosamine. Oh, it's crazy,
what are
right?
What you taking?
It's everything basically that, you know, you can take, I think so. It's hard for me to do it every day, but I'm doing it because, you know, my blood work's really good. So I'm like, well, that's I guess good. Something's working, because it wasn't working before I started doing it, right? So I'm assuming that's the change. But
that's
anyway,
helpful.
So how do you educate on that?
I'd say with multivitamins, I call them nutrition insurance.
Insurance, okay.
It's like health insurance.
Okay.
You pay into it, and it may not help you every day, but when you need it, it's there for you. And I'd say a multivitamin is very similar. We found that it doesn't increase longevity or prevent chronic disease, and you're paying into it every day, but when you're short on nutrients, it's there to support
okay.
you.
Okay.
So I call it nutrition insurance.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, you know, because it's none of them are approved by FDA, right? So they're just people selling their wares,
yeah,
right?
That's
so
messy. Yeah.
Yeah, you're just thinking, well, okay, I'm doing it anyway. It could be killing me, but I'm just going to keep doing it. So I don't know if it's helping, but.
Well, and it's, I actually teach that the reason we do service learning in my grad class is because tactical, traditional or tactical athletes, huge customers of supplements.
Okay.
So it's a group that really could use education on how do I know it works? How do I choose a quality one? How do I use them safely? So we do all kinds of stuff on all that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
What about like protein or BCAAs or the infamous pre-workout, that type of stuff?
Which all of my groups actually asked about for class. So my students are making all these materials right now. No, not all of it. No. Okay, maybe some of it.
Oh. I'll do that too.
Like, I had my pre-workout protein shake this morning. Not pre-workout, just protein.
Yeah. Well, so BCAAs, I just had a student do a presentation in class on that one. The vast majority of Americans are eating more than enough protein. As long as you're getting enough protein in your diet, BCAA.
Okay, quick question. Mm-hmm. What is the, what's the standard intake on protein?
Well, classic dietitian response, it depends.
Okay, so I'm 250 pounds.
Then the next questions are medical conditions and performance goals.
A little blood pressure, a little bit. Otherwise, just staying healthy. That's really what I want to do. So there's my goals.
How about in terms of like strength training and
increasing? So I do that about 3 or 4 times a week.
And
so
then cardio, are you trying to increase muscle mass?
Not at this point. Maintain.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have different recommendations, like for the general population, healthy, don't be deficient, is 0.8 grams per kilogram.
Okay.
But in the athletic population, you know, you are training, trying to at least maintain
it. I don't know if I call it training.
Yeah.
I do go in the gym.
You're training for life.
It's not like full training. I'm training for life. There you go. That's right.
You're working out, Darren.
You're a life
different.
Athlete.
That's different.
Lance would call you a life athlete. I'll try and translate into pounds because I feel like kilograms doesn't mean anything to anybody. I'd say it's about like 0.5 to 0.7 grams per pound. Research tends to show if you go over 0.9 to 1 gram per pound, it's just extra and it doesn't give you the gains that you want.
Yeah. Well, I try to teach my son. My son's 27, right? So he's started working out a few years ago and his trainer tells him he's got to have a gram per pound, right? Well, he's probably 220. And I only try to get 100 a day. At least 100, that's all I try to get to, because I'd always kind of thought that too, is that, you know, how much can your body actually use, right?
And so, yeah, spread it out throughout the day.
What's the downside of too much protein?
If you go above your needs, mm-hmm. so it's not helping maintain lean muscle mass or add lean muscle mass, then it's just extra calories that are quite expensive at that point that could be used for other things, like maybe you're not getting enough fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
I'd rather you shift your calories.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm getting educated today.
I know. I find
gym talk is different from professional talk, right?
Yes.
So I trust this more than I trust gym talk, yes. Right? So it's good.
No, I find all of this so interesting in your whole tactical fitness and nutrition lab. I just think it's all so fascinating, and I could sit here and talk about this all day, but I know that everyone has other things going on, and we can't do that. Nor do I think people want to listen to this for 5 hours.
Well, nutrition is the key to life, right? I mean, if you get that right, you know, you can maybe live a long time, right?
It's a leading risk factor for a lot of things.
It is, it is. So,
Dr. Jill Joyce, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Really appreciate it. I think Darren and I both learned a little bit about diets and how much protein we need to eat.
Or not.
Right? Or not eat, yeah.
Food, right. Environment, protein.
There you go.
Exactly.
It's all good.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening or watching this episode of the Inside OSU podcast. On behalf of my co-host, Darren Trum, I'm Megan Robinson. Go Pokes.
Go Pokes.